I wanted to talk to somebody else about this. Somebody who was familiar with the social aspects of science and academic life in general. So I went to a professor in philosophy, Helen Longino. She knows a lot about the social side of what goes on in the scientific community. And this is what she said.
I think that in any intellectual community, not just a scientific community, but in any intellectual community, there's going to be a sense of what counts as a genuine question within that community. And that's based on the available tools for inquiry in that community. It's based on tradition, history, how a field has developed over time. So it's not surprising that when new ideas or ideas that seem not to work within the existing framework are introduced, that there's resistance to that. And it depends on, you know, the character of the ideas an awful lot of the time, and the relation of those ideas to the extant framework. What these people are reporting about their colleagues feeling worried about being associated with them, I think, wouldn't necessarily be unique to science. That is, you know, somebody in philosophy who was doing something that was perceived to be beyond the pale might engender the same kind of response. And in fact, really, you know, feminist work in a lot of disciplines has early on, not so much these days, but early on provoked a similar kind of response on the part of academics who were really afraid to be seen to be supportive of feminist ideas because they felt they would be perceived as less than rigorous. That was based, I think, a large part on a misunderstanding of what feminists were advocating, and maybe a willful misunderstanding. But so this certainly does happen. And I think the question to be asked when these kind of social phenomena are going on, the question to be asked from an external perspective is, well, what's actually going on here? Is the resistance a resistance of fear? Or do people feel that somehow their social position is being threatened? Or is there some genuine intellectual reason for not embracing the new idea? So I think that's really what, as philosophers and historians thinking about this, we want, that's among the things we want to think about. It's also just, from a point of view of social history, interesting to see what happens.
There was another foreboding challenge that Pear faced in their work. They were finding anomalies, which, by definition, didn't fit into our current theoretical framework of science. They had to try to find a theory to fit their observations, and constructing a theory is more difficult than it may sound. I asked them about some of their current theoretical models.
The overarching thing we've just called science of the subjective. How does one do a science where the principal correlates are subjective in character? But within that framework, we've made a number of attempts. First shot at it was to take traditional quantum mechanics, as a la Bohr and Schrödinger and Heisenberg and those cats, and see whether that couldn't reasonably be regarded as a metaphorical base for a representation of the functioning of consciousness. And the answer is we think it can. And we wrote a couple of hefty papers called On the Quantum Mechanics of Consciousness. But what one finds coming out at the end of all the mathematical huffing and puffing is consciousness atoms, consciousness molecules, consciousness materials, consciousness principles, a la uncertainty, indistinguishability, complementarity, all the good stuff that previously had been regarded as totally mechanistic in nature. You can go a long way with a quantum mechanics of consciousness. So that was number one. The second attempt we called M5. It's called a modular model of mind-matter manifestations. You got to read that. I can't summarize it in 20 words or less. But the essential ingredients are an invocation of the unconscious mind in the process and an invocation of the subphysical or intangible physical concepts in the model. Just as our conscious minds, if you will, float on top of an unconscious reservoir of processing, so the usual physics 101 models of matter and energy and mechanics and whatnot float on top of substrates of much less tangible physical conceptualization. The simplest forms, of course, are the waves and the electromagnetic propagation. But going right on down that staircase to string theory, chaos theory, the whole nine yards of really intangible stuff on which the other tangible physical ramifications prevail. So what do you gain by this? Well, the hypothesis here is that when you get way down into the unconscious on the one side of the house and way down into the subphysical on the other side of the house, they know how to talk to each other. That the unconscious mind does know how to manipulate the intangible physical world and vice versa. It's a two-way street, you see. And so now we can, if not explain, at least associate things like mind-matter interactions with a process that starts in the conscious mind by an intention, by a certain conceptual base, dumps it into the unconscious mind, where it diffuses across into the subtangible, manipulates that, and then the tangible physical world begins to recognize what's going on and expresses it there. It can work the other way, of course. We can get information by so-called anomalous means by going the other way through that tunnel.
When I met with Helen Longinot, I asked her about what happens when a body of evidence doesn't fit within a theoretical framework. And I also asked her how theories are made. And she had a good historical example of just such a case.
Sometimes it tries to modify theory. And I think here, for example, of the experiments of Michelson and Morley in the late 19th century, where they were trying to measure the speed of light and the speed of light through the ether. And they constructed an experiment with what was called an interferometer, and they were going to measure the light fringes on this interferometer. And the idea was that when the instrument was in a direction that was orthogonal to the what we might call the ether wind, light would be slowed down. Passage of light would be slowed down, whereas when it was going in the same direction, the passage of light would be seen via the interferometer to be faster. They found no difference. The interferometer bands just showed absolutely no difference, no matter in what direction the interferometer was going, which, given that most physicists thought that, in fact, there was this ether, posed a real problem. Well, one solution was to think, well, when something was moving as fast as light moves in a direction against the ether, it contracts. This was called the Lorentz contraction. So that was a way of modifying the theory to accommodate these anomalous observations. Now, when Einstein came along with relativity theory, Einstein said, basically he said, the speed of light is a constant, and there was no need for the ether hypothesis. So it just went out the window. And it wasn't, Einstein didn't come up with relativity theory to accommodate these anomalous data. He came up with it for theoretical reasons, but as a consequence, those data that were anomalous from a Newtonian perspective became the expected outcome of the experiment. There are two routes that the community can take when anomalous data are discovered like this. One is to try to modify the theory, and another is to try to discount the data. Michelson and Morley were highly respected scientists, and you know they were very careful in what they did, and so it was very difficult to discount their work. And anybody else who'd used the interferometer would have gotten the same results.
So far, I'd uncovered that there are a number of social and theoretical factors that come into play in the making of science. But on a very practical level, I wanted to know how we can judge a valid experiment from a potentially invalid one. What are the markers of good science? I asked Longinot this question.
I would look for precision. I would look for specifications by which measurements are made. I would look for clarity of concepts. I would look for real controls in the experiment. I would look for the kinds of statistical methods that are being used to analyze the data. I would look for things like the quantity of experiments that have been produced, the number of subjects. You know, in part it depends on what exactly is being claimed, but those are some of the things I would look for, and I would really look for real specificity and in describing the actual observational and experimental phenomena that are being proposed as requiring some new framework.